share today, today's conversation. They're good friends, old friends, and I think we're all in for a treat. And for those of you who were with us last night, I apologize for repeating myself, but I'm going to extend what I said about Isaac last evening to Ruby. And I think both Isaac and Ruby were queer before queer was cool. And we appreciate their leading the way, and hope you guys get to see the show, and we'll have a conversation. So, thanks so much.
Information. So the thing in relationship to trying to picture or make visible something like Black Gay Desire, in some senses, was not completely abstract, but if you was trying to look for the legacy of this, one couldn't find that necessarily in pictures. You know, they were kind of in songs or hidden in the archives somewhere between letters of exchange between Hughes and Wallace Furman, two Harlem Renaissance artists. And in a sense, you know, you could say that there was a kind of enigma that was at the center of trying to create a work such as this. And I think one of the keys to creating the work was through looking at sort of black and white photography, and looking at black and white photography through the lens of people like Van der Zee, and also George Platt Lyons, which is, in a sense, the quotation of photographic triptych that you have behind me. So there's looking at this kind of vernacular, looking at this language, and thinking about how one could translate that language to make it resonate for a community and myself, you know, where you're thinking very much about how can you make a repository of a sort of gay sort of history, which has specific reference to artistic production. And in a sense, one of the keys was the Harlem Renaissance. Now, when I went to St. Martin's School of Art with Neil, over there, we were both students at St. Martin's School of Art, so in the film course, we didn't have like any courses around these sort of subjects. You know, I was looking these things up and seeking them in the library. I came across this wonderful book of Van der Zee, and I thought, my God, this is a whole world. And so in a way, I went on a kind of exploration of the Harlem Renaissance over the next sort of 4 to 5 years, and it was this exploration of finding out about this artistic milieu, which basically was very connected to modernism, especially American modernism and painting, poetry, and coming across Langston Hughes's poetry, and then reading Arnold Rampersad's biography on him, and really finding out around this question of this double life aspect to him, and then started to conjure what could be a possible world, and that world was conjured through lists, finding things, you know, odd things like a cassette which was dedicated to black gay jazz songs. It's called Sissy Man Blues, and precisely this cassette tape of Sissy Man Blues gave me a kind of language, a key into thinking, yes, it could be jazz, it could be black and white photography, it could be a world that could be explored and in a way sort of help me picture this question of the archive and how to reconstitute it for a new audience. And so that led to a whole archival trail, which Ruby, you know, was one of the first people I spoke to when I reached New York. I was saying, do you think it's a good idea to do this film? And you said, yes. And I'm very happy with your reply. And you introduced me to Joel Gomez, who I know lives now here in the city, and you know, she said, yes, that would be a good idea. And then I met Hilton Arles. And when I met Hilton Arles, he said, yes, it would be a good idea. And by the way, you know, I knew Langston Hughes' lover. His name is called Wallace Furman. I worked for him. I've written a text called An Introduction to Negro Faggotry in Reference History.
Wow.
And so basically that, in a way, started the ball rolling. And in a way, coming across the poems of Bruce Nugent laid Lilies, Smoke Lilies and Jade, and the photographs at the back, this triptych here, is a kind of visualization of that poem, which ends with the large poem at the back. And there you have the lilies, and it was a reference to that poem. So, in a way, a lot of the images are references to poems, they're like visualizations of poems. This photograph over here is called I Love My Friend. And the poem goes something like this. I've recited it to a couple of people. This by Jessica Parfin. The poem goes, I love my friend. He went away from me. There's nothing more to say. The poem ends as softly as it began. I love my friend. And so basically that's a Hughes poem which is dedicated to one of his lovers. And basically there's a number of different poems that he wrote that have lots of references to kind of, I would say his kind of, well, homosexual desire. The Hughes estate would have something else to say about that. But basically, in some senses, reading a lot of literary texts, letting those literary texts lead my way, and then looking at black and white archival film, and letting that lead the way for how to picture this kind of moment. And really these various conversations were basically led to fascinating, made this jigsaw possible. But really, I would say that black and white cinema and black and white photography became the unitary visual language to tie what is quite fragmentary information together.
And it was a time when people were looking at the past through the lens of the present and not being meticulous about some kind of periodicity. So that Derek Jarman was doing anachronistic historical settings for his films, so that one could have Jimmy Somerville as an angel in the balcony of the Harlem Renaissance without that arousing any shock, because we were becoming used to this kind of time travel back and forth in those periods. And I want to talk a lot more about this time, but I also want to perhaps skip for a moment to this central brilliance and, I think, confusion about what these images actually are. That they're not frame enlargements from the film, that they're made from the stills, which are, by definition, photographs taken on the set of the film by a photographer for the filmmaker, for the film, usually to be used as publicity. Usually they're not a very elevated form of photography, except when it's Isaac. And I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about that, because I think I've noticed the confusion. And so on the one hand, we have a frame enlargement, where someone just takes the film and copies that. We have a publicity still. And then we have something else, which is a freeze frame. And a freeze frame is when the film stops, as it sometimes does, and time is stilled. Time is kind of captured in the moment and held there. And I love the idea of this interplay between these different kinds of still images, as well as freeze having, of course, this other connotation of the journal, the art fair, and all the rest that goes under the name of freeze. But what about these images? I mean, when did it occur to you that these images could stand alone, that they could stand apart from the film and could be revived in a completely different way from how the film could be revived?
Well, I think I've always wanted to make a series of photographs from these works, because in some senses, I would say my relationship to making images and making pictures are the beginnings of how I make films. And so how I think about making cinema, and in the methodology of making this work, Looking for Langston is no different from making a work like 10,000 Waves or Playtime. You know, that basically all starts with visual research, and that research is foregrounded and can take the course of a number of years. And so, in a sense, with Looking for Langston, I've always wanted to make photographic works from the body of images that exist, because there are over 1,000 images taken at the time. And so the way that I work then is not very dissimilar to how I work now. So if the body of images to 10,000 Waves might be 5,000, then, you know, there's only a very selected, you know, repertoire of images that I would choose. And also the way that the images get made are connected to having resources of a cinema production crew. I mean, so they could be made in any other way, because you need to have the costume designer, the lighting designer, makeup. You need to have, you know, a lot of stuff to be able to make the works. So they're not, it's not just like a photography lighting. So, and then I think the other thing around making the works, I mean, and I think in a sense the new technology is playing to this now, is the kind of possibility to be able to make the works exist as they would be in a cinematic sense or cinematic frame. And so, in a sense, even though these are shot on 16mm, you know, and it's about this small, and if you shoot them on 35mm film, it's about that small, the images themselves are being constructed to be projected large. And so, therefore, it's only really now, I would say, 2016, that we probably have the technology where we can make the images exist in this manner without the compromise of the kind of digitalization effect. you know, because there's a lot of sensitivity between analog and digital and what those mediums are, the medium specificity. And there's a kind of sensitivity, I think, between the fact that we're oversaturated with many images that are produced digitally, which, to a certain extent, we know about, you know, I think probably Sidney Sherman is the most astute person who's working in relationship to making a commentary about, for example, you know, how women are represented in that medium and through advertising, and we know the kind of problems of digitalization and, you know, people being given a kind of facelift, etc., through those means, right? And so they're kind of things that we're really familiarized with. And there is a kind of, well, in Europe, a kind of, not backlash, but you could say that in some camps of photography, they would argue that digital photography killed off photography, you know. I mean, if you said that to a new German school, you know, something like Andras Gursky, I mean, I think he might just chuckle to himself, you know, because obviously, you know, in that school, it's very much about the way that those technologies have really enabled a new aesthetic language. So, you know, so I guess that brings it full circle, because these works are printed all in Germany, they're printed by Grieger, they're printed by the company that was set up by the new German School of Photography, and within that, then, there's a whole relationship between the analog and those techniques, and not to over-fetishize them, but basically there's a way in which it's only possible to produce some of these images in this kind of way now. And it was really through my conversation with Sally Mann when I was in Rome at the American Academy, where she brought it to my attention that, you know, there's a way in which you can make images where you can take a kind of master print of a work that's black and white, get a digital copy done at a super high resolution, and that this digital copy can then be turned back into a film negative, and then you can print that work back in an analog fashion. So, in a way, the intertextuality between the different works and the way that the medium specificity works, both relying on analog and digital and all of these things, is almost like a very interesting period. Photography, you know.
So you're really talking about a completely hybrid approach to photography now. I mean, that results in the possibility for the first time of photographs of that scale from something that's originally an analog image.
Yeah, but without it resulting to it being like a sort of, without losing the kind of analog aspects of the image, you see what I mean? So I think that's the thing, you know, because of course, you know, there's a role of digital retouch and all of these very sinful activities,
so
you know, which
ascribe
to some schools of black and white photography. So, I'm not trying to, for any moment, suggest other photographers. Yeah. I like making images, you know, so kind of, you know, and I'll do that by any means possible, to, you know. But
can we talk about digital retouch? Because, of course, the Pee Wee Herman film, Occasion, Paul Rubens, going to the press and talking about how everyone is now being digitally retouched in their films. So they're looking at how digital facelifts that everyone's getting. But at the same time, filmmakers who are now making new digital masters of films that were originally shot, sometimes very low budget, on 16mm, have talked about literally relighting their work. Like, well, this is how I would have lit it if I had the money back then. So that Swoon, for instance, made around the same time, made a little bit later, was released on DVD, and the original cinematographer, Ellen Kurris, came in and relit it digitally, according to how she wished she had lit it originally. And you were just saying that these photographs couldn't have been done without the resources of a film set because of this whole corpus of lighting cameraman, the makeup, and so on. And I want to get you to talk a bit about the lighting, because there's clearly not only a Harlem Renaissance and photographic influence, but also a film noir influence, especially a photograph like this with the billowing smoke or the indeterminacy of that kind of image. I wonder if you talk a bit about that too.
Well, I think in a way, sort of film noir was an important, you know, genre to think about, make a work which is very much, in a sense, represented in a period where, you know, the relationship between questions of mortality, you know, heightened. And so, in a sense, it's also connected to the repertoire of black and white photography and the expression, German expressionism, you know, but so in the sort of avant-garde position of forming that as an aesthetic. Nina Kalgrim, the cinematographer who worked with Nina Tambor, the gaffer, I mean, we worked and looked at many black and white films, film noir films, and we made sure that we saw those films projected on black and white film stock. I mean, it wasn't just that. A lot of black and white films were being printed on colour stock, so we wanted to look at true black and white, what true black and white looks like. And I think a lot of this was very also connected to the fact that in terms of the politics of lighting, which is a whole development, a whole aesthetic conversation between filmmakers across the diaspora, so filmmakers like Julie Dash or, you know, Spike Lee, myself, we're all talking about the politics of lighting around black subjects. And so in a way there was a kind of litmus test in relationship to these works, because basically in film, if you had a black subject, they would literally disappear like out of the frame.
And it's so much photography and photojournalism and other films, that the gray zone that was set for setting the lighting was set for white skin. It wasn't recalibrated. It didn't have a flexible set of standards. It was very...
Yeah, but the whole technology towards... film is a non-neutral technology, and so the non-neutrality of the technology is such that you have to sometimes work against the kind of structure of it to enable, and you have to pay, you know, in some sense, it's special attention, you know. So, I mean, and if you think about digitalization, I mean, I had a conversation with Jeff Clark, who's the CEO of Kodak, who said that digital technology is completely bias against the terms of dark skin, you know, that basically it's a technology that's completely biased in its form, literally, towards white skin tones. And many black actors are complaining and don't want to be shot through digital technology. They prefer to be shot on film. Well, many actors would prefer to be shot on film, because as we know, digital technology makes people, they look basically crap, you know. So basically, I know, because I shot up work on digital, and it was a killer to try to make that work look great, you know. So, but I mean, in relationship to the politics of sort of representation, this question then of how you would enable to create an image that would be a desirable image of a black subject, and all of these things were investigated in the early photographs of people like Van der Zee and in some of the works of George Bradley Lyons, and then also Robert Mapplethorpe, you know, became very important because of the way that he was really trying to make a sculptural object of the black male body to a certain extent. And so all of those things were really huge discussions that are happening in a black British context of artists and theorists.
And you were writing at that time. When was it that you and Kogan and Mercer co-edited that special issue of Scream that was called The Last Issue on Race? That was what they provocatively titled it. But that was a little earlier than this?
It was around 1988.
Around
the same time. And David A. Bailey, who was a curator then, basically... created an exhibition which was called something connected to Harlem Renaissance, and it came here to San Francisco, that exhibition, but it was the first exhibition that was looking at this modernist period in American history, and looking at the black sort of, cultural artistic legacy of that movement. So there's a lot of interest in it, and I think the interest in it stemmed from the fact that we were really interested And I would say the legacy of that debate is really not, it's really interesting about it, because it's really interesting to think about that the Tate today basically will have an exhibition on black abstraction in painting, or they'll have an exhibition on the representation of black power in contemporary sort of art, American focus, and, or you'll even get a show on pop and its relationship to conceptualism, but from a global framework, you know, and you'll get lots of different interests from curators going to Tate. And I would say that the legacy of all of those debates are sort of in some of the thinking of the museums today, you know. And I think what's interesting is that you can almost say that although we have lots of problems with the Tate, Akin's not here now, is he? Well, Akin actually, you know, is one of the really top creators. He's really fantastic. He's done fantastic shows. He thinks about these things all the time. But on the whole, I mean, you know, I would think that it'd be interesting whether that legacy, which is actually in America, is reflected in the kind of museum, you know, new museums, you know, curatorial remits today, you know. Yeah, or not. So I think, I mean, all of these debates are happening at that particular time, and a lot of cinematographers who I was working with, I mean, you know, they were mainly white, some of them were black. I mean, we were all thinking about these questions, and those questions were seen as something that was quite an exciting thing to think about, rather than a detrimental thing to think about. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's funny that at the time when you made Looking for Langston, 16mm was the mode of production. That was, all of these changes hadn't yet occurred. The biggest change in the 80s was the start of cable and MTV and music video, and the impact that that then had on artistic creation moving forward into the 90s, and the invention of video and camcorders and home video. But there was no way to project video. Digital wasn't around yet. It was video, and it couldn't be projected. If you went to a film festival, you couldn't see a video. You had to come to a gallery and look at a little monitor in the corner if you wanted to see video. So the worlds of film and of video were completely separate worlds, and technologically were, you know, several eons further down the road. And you started out making these, what would now be called a single channel piece. You started out making films that had scripts and had a built-in linearity to them as they were shown on the screen. And I remember talking with you some years ago when you made Long Road to Mazatlan, which is seen in the color photogravures in the back gallery. And we were talking at that time about the difference between installation pieces and works that were made to be shown in theaters. And I remember talking with you particularly about what happens to desire in the move from that narrative engine that moves an audience through a story and through characters and through an unfolding of a narrative, and what happens when that is split into multiple screens and when they are seen in gallery space. And at that time, you were working with three screens. You hadn't yet gone to the nine screens of 10,000 Waves, or now, what are you up to now, 16 screens for the Lino Bacaro? What are you up to?
You showed it 15 screens.
15 screens, sorry.
But it's not that more screens are better.
No, we're not a screen queen. But what it then means to have not screens, but these multiples of these photographs in the gallery. And what does still photography do to desire? How does this function differently now, as we're surrounded by all of these gorgeous images? I wonder, how does it feel to you?
Well, I think, in a sense, the relationship between, I would say, a lot of my images are made from the idea of a kind of tableau vivant sort of style. And so, in a way, then, usually what one's doing is perhaps using a tracking shot to give that movement as an image. But it usually begins in this formation of something which is pictorial, it could be from a painting, etc. So, but I think in relationship to, well, if I compare the photogravures to the freeze frame of The Long Road to Madeline, I think what was interesting about sort of trying to adopt the idea of not having a script, of shooting something which could be partly indexical, part documentary, and then infusing that with a certain lyricism, and then making it work in a more notational way with the image when you're making multiple works or multiple screen works, of, you could get into this visual syncopation of the images, and that's how the narrative can unfold. And to some extent, I think when you're installing works, you know, that you're creating a kind of mise-en-scene, you know, you're creating an environment where basically the spectator is a kind of en passage, you're kind of moving through, and you're kind of like a camera. You could say
we perform
our own tracking shots, and you're looking at work, and then how it's punctuated, and how something works from one space to the other is really also part of the language of how you're viewing, you know. And I should say that Jessica is pretty masterful at this, because she's incredibly sort of, and not, I would say, a lot of, not all galleries have it, you know, this kind of curatorial eye and how your space works and what that, how it works. And then it takes a long time as well, you know, in a pictorial setting, you're having to arrange the images, and, which are not emulating the film, but making their own space and their own montage. But there is a kind of montage that's happening, and it's this question of montage when you're working with multiple screens, which is very interesting. You can use this parallel montage to play with time, to play with natural expectations, and to make different associations come alive in a way that you can't in a kind of more linear film, where the kind of narrative is being driven by a story and be driven in other sorts of ways.
I want to go back to this question of historical period again for a moment with you, because I wonder, the allure of these images is so extreme. Partly it's because of these gorgeous photographs that you've made, but and partly it's because of the mise-en-scene you've created.
There's a lot of help.
But it's also partly because of a sort of lingering nostalgia that we all have for this time before. This time before our current contemporary life, when things were different. And you know, this is the year, this past year, when Todd Haynes made Carol, and I was at Sundance in January, and I said, well, I wonder if this is going to now kick off a new fashion, a new nostalgic repression for this remembering of what was lost when all the barriers came down, of this kind of romance and excitement and mystery and specialness and coded language and coded visibility. And it's a perverse thing to say, maybe, given how the difficulties of life in those times. But at the same time, today, when all that has been flattened out so completely, I wonder about this world that you were reviving and creating both, and what it means to all of us now, what these images mean. How do they mean differently in 2016 than they ever meant before?
Well, I do think that, you know, I talk about this question of sort of the period of when they were made originally, which is a period where, you know, there is this question of mortality, which is very high. And so therefore, I think there's, you know, so I spoke about the question of film noir, and that's a kind of genre which, in some senses, visually replicates the idea of danger and suspense, which is in kind of sexuality, in sexual practices to a certain degree. But then, at the same time, I think there's a way in which... I mean, I thought this actually quite a lot when I was looking at Carol, because to a certain extent, and it's one of the things that came up in the Black Room conversations, and it's something which I've observed really as someone who's observing America a little bit at a distance, but at times there's a kind of circling around certain questions or circling around certain developments, you know. So on one level, we're in this moment where there's been this sort of black presidency over two series, and then at the same time, you could almost say that we're almost back in Baldwin's America.
That's right.
So I think there's this double oscillation between being sort of pulled back, let's say, and then at the same time being moving forward. And I thought about this particularly in relationship to Carol, because I was thinking about this question of a kind of lesbian protagonist romance, and the way in which you know, this is a kind of representation which is still rare, you know, to be pushed into a Hollywoodian mode, but then at the same time it's harking back to this 50s kind of, you know, language. And of course, you know, Todd Haynes is very you know, his homage to Cirque, you know, is there all the time. And, you know, you get Trump, you get these discourses of pulling, wanting to pull things back. Do you see what I mean? And so I feel there's this kind of tension.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that results in an aesthetic which is in some ways mirroring that tension. You know, so it's harking back to the historical period, but the questions that have been foregrounded, you know, are different today in terms of a certain modernity or contemporaneity around sexuality and identities, but nonetheless, you know, there's still this pulling back that's kind of taking place. And so, you know, and I think there's this tension that's alive, you know, in debates about photography, aesthetics, but in terms of the representations, then they are still representing what could be a kind of critical nostalgia. So I wouldn't say that it's just nostalgia, but there's a, you know, there is that aspect of sort of trying to still grapple with those questions, and, you know. But, you know, we have moved on and shifted a lot, and I think, you know, there's a way in which sort of implied in the title, Vintage, is the idea that it's really attention to the medium specificity, if you like, without fetishizing it. Mm-hmm. So,
well, the past still has its grip. You know, the ghosts are still around in smoke, and yet here we are.
Yeah.
I have a question for Jessica. I'm thinking of opening it up so we can begin to have the conversation. Is that in keeping it, if you'd like?
That sounds great.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
And just thinking as you compose your thoughts, I'm thinking about Carol. Of course, it's based on Patricia Highsmith. And for Highsmith, mortality was never far away from sex. Never. I mean, Talented Mr. Ripley is a great queer film, and you don't get too far with that. It was never, you know, queer desire was never clean for her. It was never safe, I would say. So, any thought? This is a wonderful audience. I know many of you here in the room, and I want to hear from you. So, if you have thoughts for Isaac or questions you want to introduce into the conversation, let us know.
Open the door.
Since you brought up Carol, I think one of your book films, one of your book works that are related to the past, one of the main distinctions that I noticed with Carol, there's a lot of vegetation of Carol in the way of trying to accept her, and she's kind of objectified, whereas these images, they're beautiful, but what I appreciate about them is how
sorry.
Yes, there's a lot of Callow and the way in which Callow as a character is fetishized and perhaps objectified in the film, but that's not the case of Shakespeare's themes. And do you have anything to say about that?
Well, I think we wanted to fetishize the black body to such a extent. You know, that was one of the points of making the work. So, yeah. We wanted to see a like, sexy black body, and, you know, that was kind of important.
And trust as well.
And in trust as well. Yeah, so I think there was that idea. But I think we made the participatory part, and I think that's perhaps why having that other photographs were more towards a more traditional production still,
yes,
where you have all the participants. And I think viewing it now, I can see that it was a kind of community collaboration, you know, because all the people in the work weren't actors as such, they were friends and colleagues. And to a certain extent, I think there was a kind of acknowledgement of what one was doing and that people were willing this, you know, together. So there was a very conscious, you know, I did yoga this morning, and in fact, one of the people, the main protagonist, Ben Ellison, who plays the Langton character, was a yoga.
Oh, really?
And he used to, during the outtakes, take the whole group, and they would do this kind of class. But we were trying to start the class. I thought that was very interesting. But I can just say there was a very camaraderie kind of, you know, on the set, and that people were really very excited, and there was a kind of not that sort of, because sometimes when you're making a work in this context, you can get a hierarchy that comes very connected to the film industry, and also the crew was an all-women crew. And sometimes when we had some of the electricians come, I remember one person came up to me and said, "Oh, I see, this is like a kind of, yeah, you're black, everybody's gay, but oh, women crew, I get it," you know. So it was like kind of this, there was some trick that's being played in a kind of more industrial industry sense, which is usually, you know, it's usually guys, and it's new. Do you see what I mean? So there's a reversing of the gaze in the work, I think, that was taking place, and a sharing of that.
And in the very production of that, this was such a key historic time that I think there was a sense that there has never been anything like this before. And this sense that you were enabling something to come into being. That this was, you know, you're living in historic times, the way I always think of it.
Yeah.
And so it has a power beyond what could be explained by the fact of making this film.
Yeah.
I'd like to follow up on that comment. I really liked it. And I was thinking about how the images are like you before, but not like you before.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about how in all the images there's relation. Relationality is present. And so much of makeup work, not all, but most of makeup work, the figure is alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so although the sculptural beauty of makeup work and the lighting is absolutely there in the two images right behind you, Isaac, but that there's two men together. And so what's really big image is their intimacy, their relation. Pleasure is another word for it, but I really saw intimacy and relation beyond objectification in the case because of the doubleness, or sometimes the triple or the multiplicity. Then they come together, right? And so I think that is what really moves me about these images in the way that the makeup work project is different. So I wonder if you want to comment.
So could you all agree with that? So a wonderful question about the relationship of this work to makeup work's images. And pointing out that a key difference is relationality, that it's most often not one figure in the frame, but two, and that this relationality is absolutely central. This work.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Robert Mapplethorpe was really a very signature presence at the time of making the work, and in the film itself it has a whole sort of section that has Robert Mapplethorpe images, and so therefore, you know, that shows a kind of correlation, and we were looking at his work very closely. So, I mean, I think, you know, there's a make Hawkian aspect in some of these works, but I think, you know, the thing around Metropolis is that object sculpture relationship, a very sculptural, almost dissociated classical photographer kind of relationship to the image, and making that image in the form of lighting and flowers and, you know, black bodies, you know, Lisa Meyer and all of this. I mean, they were really, he was super important, and especially in relationship to the Black Book. I remember going to Los Angeles and when he made that book, and I went to dinner, it was a black cake dinner, and they had the Black Book, and they were passing this Black Book among themselves and looking at that book, and that was a very important book. People were looking at that book and savouring it. And in a way, you could say that almost his gaze of being appropriated. And of course, there are lots of debates about it. Once you saw, you know, like man in a polyester suit in a gallery, then it changed everything, you know. But it was these different kinds of readings that could be read from it. But I think sort of there is. I mean, I think that's where the cinema comes in, perhaps, you know, narrative, and that, you know, if you were making an image in that sort of way, more from a cinephilic perspective, you know, I wouldn't be interested in just making an image of just, I mean, in that sense, no, I'm not classical photographer at all, you know, except these works, very influenced by George Platt lines. So kind of they're copies essentially.
I wanted to follow up on Jennifer's comment, and that is thinking of, that was such a great observation. And I was trying to figure out, you know, the difference between the response of the viewer to the Mapplethorpes and this, and a lot of it is the presence of desire. And I mean that's strong in terms of the expressions on the faces and the relationship that's happening, and even the desire for someone who's not there in the photo, but someone that they're obviously thinking about. And it looks like that was almost a very important lens. Did you talk about that?
So again, you couldn't hear that, returning back to Mapplethorpe again, but now talking about these being different because of the presence of desire and the way in which desire is figured in these images.
Well, then all the actors were given, like, Langston Hughes poems, you know, for example. And whenever we were shooting, you know, they were all told to think about these works. So, in a sense, like, that was the kind of narrative information that they were given towards their characters. And so, therefore, you know, in that sense, it is a kind of thinking process that one's capturing. So you're not just capturing the person, but there's the mood that you want to conjure, you know, and so that's very, very important, you know, and also a lot of the time when I'm shooting, the music or the sonic research gets done quite in advance, and so there was an artist that lives in the Bay Area called Blackberry, who wrote two songs, Beautiful Black Men and Blues for Langston, and I had these songs recorded a year before I shot the film. And so when we're shooting, we play that music, and it's a device that, you know, lots of photographers use if they're wanting their kind of
modern cinema.
And that's really also how one's getting that atmosphere in relationship to how people are performing, because it is they're performing, you know, but they're essentially all non-actors, you know. I mean, Ben Ellison was an actor, and John Wilson was an actor, but the rest of the people in the world were not actors.
And that was typical for film, any kind of queer filmmaking at that time. You couldn't get actors to play those parts. You couldn't cast those films. Yeah. So they were always through friendship networks and connections and kinship systems outside of the acting profession, outside of SAG. I want to introduce one other name while we're talking, which is, we should talk about Langston Hughes. But what I remember is that when you came to New York in 1987 to do the research for Looking for Langston, you happened to be there when James Baldwin died, and you were there for the huge memorial funeral for James Baldwin at Riverside Church. And I wonder about Baldwin and the Baldwin legacy in this work as well.
Well, in a way, the Baldwin legacy begins at the beginning of the film, where Toni Morrison reads a eulogy that is from the actual service, where she talks about a person does not like be elected to oppose a society. He prefers to be among his compatriots rather than be detested and despised by them. She's quoting Baldwin, you know, and in a sense, I think that was her talking about Baldwin's experience, but also talking about perhaps homophobia, you know, that he had experienced from the black communities, which resulted in his exilic condition. But it had a double entendre for me, because also I realised at the moment that no one could really talk about Baldwin's sexuality, you know, even for someone who was such an out, you know, iconic black queer writer. It led me to think about this question of enigma of the epistemology of the closet, and then that gave a kind of clue to making the work in relationship to Langston Hughes, then becoming this figure that could be this sort of, have this double entendre aspect to him as a representative of the difficulty of trying to speak about this subject within these communities. So in a way, there are references to Baldwin, and we see pictorial references, which I found in the archive. At one point, it was pointed out to me that actually, when the Hughes estate objected to the association with Hughes and homoeroticism, that it might be better to call it Looking for Jimmy. And at one point, I thought, well, maybe I could have called it Looking for Jimmy, but it didn't sound as good. And also, kind of, you know, with Jimmy, there wasn't an enigma, you know. So, and I thought it was this more enigmatic approach that created a sort of more interesting relationship, and more the condition perhaps that people had more so than not within the black communities. So,
and also, even though Baldwin is so iconic and was so out as a voice, he was much more singular. He wasn't embedded in a community like the Harlem Renaissance.
No.
He wasn't part of this kind of magical history.
No.
He stood out from it.
Yes.
So it would have been hard to remake that, reshape that. You know, other thoughts or comments? Yes.
Just an observation that I remember a number of years ago. I was in New York and I saw your film about the Statue of Liberty. And I guess I want to ask you about showing work in a gallery context, because I remember walking to the gallery and seeing this film, and I had this wonderful sense of vertigo, because you imbued Statue of Liberty with this life. And if you could sort of like maybe give us a little bit more observations about, you know, taking your filmic work and bringing it into a gallery, and also in terms of your multiple screens. I mean, I remember seeing this stuff in Miami at the Vast Museum. And again, you created this wonderful sense of vertigo where the screens were all around you, and the participant, as a viewer, you changed our perspective. And you're doing it again here, and I think it's really, I mean, I really enjoy it a lot, but I'd like you to maybe elaborate on that aspect, if that makes sense.
But I think, you know, there was a kind of move that was part anticipated, and you could say that someone like Steve McQueen, who made this work, I think is the first subject to talk about, which is the Statue of Liberty, which is a wonderful work. No, it's a wonderful work, and I really like that work. And to a certain extent, you know, someone like Steve, you know, had started his career in a gallery as an artist, making films for the gallery. And I mean, I knew Steve quite well. I was his tutor for a while when he was at Goethe's College, and he said to me, "I want to make films," you know. And I said to him, "Aha, well, you know, the film industry is a very difficult film industry. Might be better to actually make your works in an art complex And then I think those things will develop into, you know, film content. And he didn't speak to me for about 3 years after that. But the thing is, I think it was like, in a way, what was very interesting about Steve McQueen is, in some ways, you know, he's always been someone that's led the way, you know, so he has a particular kind of personality, a very strong personality. And he's someone who did lead the way in relationship to making gallery works in that context. And I think in the British context, you know, there are lots of people who are making works in that context, like Douglas Gordon, Tassa Dean, to name but a few, who I think see the legacy of the things which people like myself and Neil were involved in, of making an experimental film, and that nature of thinking about film in a context where it can be appreciated as an art form, you know. And I think in Britain, you know, we've kind of lost the argument a bit in relationship to film as an art form. You know, if you go to Visual Institute, a lot of the conversations that we have there with the director is, you know, basically, when is the government going to cut the kind of tax break for film? You know, whereas Tate Modern has completely won the argument. It basically is able to get, you know, 10 million towards government, you know, directly for its new building. You know, so in some senses, the idea of securing what film is as an art form, as a cultural, artistic form, is one of the reasons why I think there has been a move into art context. It certainly was for me. But also, I think it's the idea of experimentation and innovation. So you could explore certain techniques that you couldn't explore in film proper. And it's precisely then some of these ideas, which were very early ideas, that you can extrapolate in an art context where you also have an audience that would be willing to participate in that context. And so it's like bringing an audience with you, you know, if you can. But at the same time, realizing, you know, that there is something that's wonderful about being able to get a little philanthropy video for $25, you know, which you can get today, you know, versus, you know, if you make an artwork and it's inspired by a museum, and that is something which is going to be seen, you know, every now and then, you know, but then actually, you know, you don't get to see it that much, you know. So it has the risk of disappearance. And so it's a bit of a dilemma. It's not anything that's resolved, but I think it's, you know, to do with really the sort of artistic legacy of a form, which in some senses doesn't have it necessarily. You know, it's still quite insecure in the museum context. It still, you know, is developing. You know, it still isn't on par with painting. It isn't, you know, photography creators who came only existence like 5 years ago. You know, I mean, you know, so, yeah.
Let me ask you one final question, because I know we're over time. And these photographs are from these older productions. Are you continuing to do this? Will we someday see photographs from Playtime or Capital or 10,000 Waves?
Well, I hope so.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Isaac. Thanks so much.
Isaac will be back in November. The Cranlicks are putting on a production of Playtime down at Fort Mason. It'll be and Capitol. It'll be a 7-screen installation, and we are thrilled that you'll be back. And I hope you'll all join me in thanking Ruby and Isaac and visiting Isaac's installation in November as well.
Yeah, thank you.